Today, on this episode of the PeerDirect Special Spotlight.
There are several factors to consider. Typically, progression on BTK inhibitors, covalent BTK inhibitors, is associated with mutations in BTK, sometimes mutations in PLC gamma.
Today, Dr. Coombs and Danilov joined the podcast to discuss sequencing targeted therapies in the management of patients with CLL in this PeerDirect Specialist Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative's supporters.
Hello, I'm Dr. Callie Coombs, Associate Professor in the Division of Hematology and Oncology at the University of California, Irvine.
And I'm Dr. Alexey Danilov, a professor in the Department of Hematology and Stem Cell Transplant at City of Hope in Duarte, California.
Happy to have you here, Alexey.
The pleasure is all mine, Callie.
In the current treatment landscape for CLL, one of the most practical challenges we face in the second and third line setting is deciding how to best sequence our highly effective targeted therapies. So I think it'd be a useful exercise to go through two clinical scenarios that we all face in our day-to-day practice. The first scenario is a patient who has received a covalent BTK inhibitor in the front line and progressed while on this therapy. And so in 2025, I think we do have choices in this situation. The first option is what I've been doing mostly over the past several years, which is treating a patient with venetoclax. However, with the NCCN changes over the past several months, based on the results of the BRUIN 321 trial, another option would be to make a shift to a non-covalent BTK inhibitor, specifically pirtobrutinib. Now, keep in mind, pirtobrutinib is not yet FDA approved in this situation. However, because of its listing in the NCCN, it is something that I've had success getting based on insurance approvals. And of course, I think this FDA approval is likely forthcoming. And so, Alexey, I'd like to get your thoughts on how you would approach this decision in your own practice.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that, Kylie. So this typically involves a physician-patient discussion. There are several factors to consider. Typically, progression on BTK inhibitors, covalent BTK inhibitors, is associated with mutations in BTK, sometimes mutations in PLC gamma. And at our center, we would typically test for these mutations to try to potentially understand what might happen next. And although it's still very difficult to make the decision just based on the mutational pattern, as we still don't have enough data. And you're correct that we would have an option of switching to a BCL2 inhibitor-based therapy, whether it's venetoclax obinutuzumab or venetoclax cetuximab, or sticking with the class, meaning switching to non-covalent BTK inhibitor pirtobrutinib. And it's interesting, in BRUIN studies, patients who had progressed on both BTK inhibitor and BCL2 inhibitor and were treated with pirtobrutinib actually had shorter progression-free survival and time to next therapy than patients who only progressed on covalent BTK inhibitor. So maybe that's one factor which one might want to consider when switching from covalent to non-covalent, so to speak, staying in class. Of course, what we do not know is how venetoclax performs after patients fail both covalent and non-covalent BTK inhibitor. But treatment with venetoclax obinutuzumab or venetoclax rituximab is associated with certain cumbersomeness, such as need for TLS checks. Many patients that I see actually prefer the ease of a daily pill with a, so to speak, agent that you know. They typically wouldn't necessarily experience new adverse events as they have tolerated the BTK inhibitors for several years. So I will say that many of my patients prefer that route where they prefer to stay in class.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are pros and cons, as often we encounter in our field. Pirtobrutinib certainly has a real benefit as far as ease of use, and the safety profile is excellent. Venetoclax, I actually think, is a very safe drug for most patients, but the myelosuppression perhaps is a bit more noticeable than with pirtobrutinib, and so, you know, some patients may need growth factor here and there, but the logistics also are quite a bit more complex. But, you know, venetoclax also offers the opportunity for time-limited therapy. I think the gap in the field is that we don't know a lot about how ven performs as a time-limited therapy after a BTK inhibitor. We have a couple studies that show that, yes, ven works after a covalent BTK inhibitor, but that was looking at ven as a continuous monotherapy. The Murano trial of VEN-R, only about 2% of the patients that received VEN-R had a prior covalent BTK inhibitor. But nonetheless, I've used it plenty in my own practice, and there are real-world studies suggesting that this is a very efficacious approach. So I think it's good to have choices, and I think in the end, I end up individualizing it with any given patient.
Yeah, I agree with you. So it comes to an individualized decision. So how about the other setting where somebody has received venetoclax obinutuzumab as their frontline therapy and now they're progressing? What factors do you consider in that setting and in therapy choice?
Yeah, so venetoclax in the frontline is a regimen I use a lot of, mostly venetoclax with obinutuzumab, just because that's been around for a while. I love that it's time limited. And so most of my patients who get ven-obin are going to go into a good and deep remission to where then they'll be off therapy for some period of time. However, of course, now that more years and years have passed, I am seeing patients relapse following this regimen. And so I think the most important considerations for whether or not I would choose venetoclax retreatment or shifting to a different class, such as a covalent BTK inhibitor, would be, number one, how well did the patient tolerate the ven-obin regimen? I think most patients tolerate it well, but if a patient had a very tough time with it, which is rare, then maybe I'd have less enthusiasm for retreating. However, I think the other really important factor is, what was the duration of the patient's response? Most patients have a long time until they progress. I think the median PFS from the frontline CLL14 trial was like 76 months. And so for patients who have a long period of remission after that year on therapy, I have a high degree of enthusiasm for retreatment. Shorter remissions, I think that's a tougher question. And so I don't think there's a perfect amount of time that you need. A lot have put forth 2 years as far as an amount of time off therapy to think about retreatment. But, you know, I don't think there is an exact cut point where it's going to be successful or not. I'm excited that we have a bit of data related to how ven performs in the second line setting based on the REVENGE study, which shows 100% response rate to ven retreatment. What we don't know is how durable these responses are going to be, just because the follow-up of that trial is so far pretty short. But that'll be something I think that can really inform what we do and can educate our patients better.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. The duration of response to initial treatment with ven-based therapy is really important. The data suggests that we do not generate a whole lot of resistance mutations, BCL2 mutations, following time-limited therapy with venetoclax. There are clearly other factors, disease-related factors, which determine how long remission might last. You know, you mentioned REVENGE study of retreatment with venetoclax-based therapy. Now we have this regimen coming up, which is BTK inhibitor, BCL2 inhibitor combination regimen. And there was also a small study, HOVON study, which used acalabrutinib venetoclax in relapse setting. So that's another interesting time-limited approach that one might also consider in the future.
Yeah, I think the field will definitely shift to some extent, because acala-ven, with or without obin, is going to be an attractive frontline regimen. And so what do we do when these patients relapse? I don't think we have a lot of information, but hopefully this is something we're able to gather in the setting of not only real-world data, but maybe there will be prospective trials studying this.
Yeah, and of course, covalent BTK inhibitors are known to work post-venetoclax obinutuzumab. Retrospective studies suggest that event-free survival might be somewhere on the order of 3 years, but that also includes some intolerance cases. So I suspect these agents actually will work longer than that post-venetoclax obinutuzumab progressions, but also will depend on patient's genetic characteristics. And I do often switch class for patients who progress early. And honestly, for me, early is probably within 3 years of starting ven-based therapy.
So one last scenario I'd like to bring up is thinking about ven retreatment in perhaps a more heavily pretreated patient. And so the REVENGE study is specifically looking at second-line patients who got ven-based therapy in the front line. How do they respond to ven retreatment? We know a bit, though, about how ven responds for later-line patients, which is from the sub-study of the Murano trial, where 25 patients or so were retreated with ven-based treatment, but also from a real-world series published by Dr. Thompson and collaborators. And so, Alexei, in the situation where you have a hypothetical patient who has gotten a covalent BTK inhibitor, progressed on it, then got retreated in the second line, but with ven for the first time, then this patient relapses, what would make you think about perto versus ven retreatment in that setting?
Yeah, again, I think those would be the same factors as how long the first remission lasted. And typically, as we continue using the same ven-based treatment regimen, I would expect shorter progression-free survival each time. So if PFS on initial use of venetoclax-based therapy is short, then I would probably consider switching to pirtobrutinib. But you're right. The data suggests that most patients, if not all, respond to ven-based therapy following retreatment. And duration of response may be somewhere on the order of 2 years. I don't exactly remember the number, but it's significant. So that remains an option. You know, the other interesting point would be, okay, if you switch to pirtobrutinib in that setting, what will happen at the time of progression of pirtobrutinib? Could you potentially resensitize these patients back to venetoclax at that point? And we don't know the answer to that question.
Well, we do have a little bit of data. So Megan Thompson actually put together a real-world series that I believe was a poster at ASH. So I actually contributed data to that. But she looked at how do patients respond to therapies after they progress on a non-covalent BTK inhibitor. And so the response rate to venetoclax after a non-covalent BTK inhibitor was actually quite high. However, when they divided the patients between naive to venetoclax versus the ven retreatments, not unsurprisingly, patients who had never had ven exposure had the best responses that were the longest lasting. Patients who had had ven before, meaning they got ven, got perto, got ven again, had shorter lived responses. The numbers, though, were very small, so I think there still is a lot more to learn about that scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting data, and looking forward to more data in that space.
Well, thank you, Alexei. In the end, the choice between ven retreatment and a non-covalent BTK inhibitor in a relapse CLL patient really comes down to not only disease biology, but also some clinical considerations, such as the prior response and these practical issues that we have discussed. A deep, durable first ven remission, of course, would support retreatment, but early relapse or, of course, progression while on the therapy would then be much more support to switching to a non-covalent BTK inhibitor.
I agree. Most importantly, each decision should preserve options for the next line of therapy and keep patients eligible for emerging therapies and combinations, as well as clinical trials. It's critical that we personalize the sequence to maximize both current control and future flexibility. Thank you so much, Kali. And thank you to our audience for watching.
And that's today's special spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PeerDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at peerdirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review on your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@peerdirect.com. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, "What's my flash briefing?" Thanks today to our guest, Drs. Coombs and Danilov. Join me next time for the episode where we cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.